nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so yeah, welcome to the summer school, and this first talk is this lessons from nanoelectronics. Now, what I meant by lessons is something like this. See, what you all know is that, you know, over the last some years now, 40, 50 years, electronic devices have been getting smaller and smaller. And over the years, the size of a transistor, that is, as you know, a transistor is basically a resistor. You have some channel with two contacts, put a voltage across it, current flows. There's a resistance, which you can control with a third terminal. Now, over the years, what's happened is the length of this channel has gotten smaller and smaller. And just to have some typical dimensions on here, say 1 millimeter is something we all understand. You go down by a factor of 1,000, that's a micrometer. And you go down by another factor of 1,000, that's a nanometer. And atomic distances are somewhere down here. And of course, when this ICs were first built, the typical length of a channel would have been tens of microns, somewhere here. Whereas these days, it's like less than a tenth of a micron. So actually, if you think about it, it's amazing. The length of the channel is a few hundred atoms, really. And these are commercial devices, you know, billions of which you have in every laptop. Okay. Now, what's happened over the years is, of course, yeah, it's gotten smaller, and we have developed, in the last 20 years especially, a lot of understanding of how current flows on an atomic scale, on the nanoscale. But as it stands, though, the way you normally think about this is that nanoelectronics is kind of a separate field. What that means is you take a particular course to learn about normal devices, the way things kind of used to be, the way most devices are, you'd say. That's somewhere here. And then there is this very special thing about nanoelectronics, which tells you something about things on this scale. And when you really look at small things, that's where you are. Okay. And the point we have been trying to make is that actually nanoelectronics is not just for nanoelectronics. It actually gives you a totally different perspective on current flow in general. So it can even be useful for understanding big devices. That's it. Okay. So, for example, if you have to think about a big device, one of the first properties of a channel, of this channel that you ask for is, what's its conductivity? And what you'd learn in any freshman physics course, I mean, freshman physics texts would have this derivation usually. They would say that conductivity is given by something like this. Q is the charge on an electron. N is the number of electrons per unit volume. This is electron density. And this M is this effective mass. Tau is the mean free time. And often you write this in the form of electronic charge, electron density, mobility. That's the standard thing. As I said, any freshman physics text would usually have that. Okay. Now, another form for conductivity, less well known, but for simple conductors is actually equivalent, and that's the one I want to stress. So let me draw it, write it here. It looks something like this. Oh, by the way, usually often mobility is written with just a mu. I've put a bar on top because I'll be using mu to represent the electrochemical potential. And so just so there's no confusion, I've put a bar on top. And the same here, usually this is the density of states, D, and then there is this diffusion coefficient. And since those are, of course, two very different things, but both are usually represented with a D, I've put a bar on one of them. So that's the diffusion coefficient, and that's the density of states. And usually people write density of states as density of states per unit energy, per unit volume. But I'll be writing D as just per unit energy, so you should divide it by the volume, that's the area times the length, to get the density of states per unit energy, per unit volume. Now, this is the form that's less well-known. But on the other hand, it's not new at all. If you took a full course on solid-state physics and went through it, somewhere down the line, you'd learn about this one too. It's just that this is what you'd learn first. This is what would be in any freshman physics text. And like you take a standard book like, say, Ashcroft and Merman, it's like that first formula I wrote on top, that would be like in chapter one. And the one I wrote there, that's the one that you'll see somewhere in chapter 13. See? And so the one you carry in your head, the one that you use to think about things, is this one. See? Not this one. Not that anyone says this is wrong. They understand this. You can, with some algebra, you can show that in simple cases those two are equivalent. But this is the one that you'll usually see. Okay. But the point I want to make is that it's actually the lower one that's more general. That there are all kinds of situations where the top one won't work, will get you confused. But the lower one actually still works very well. It's less well known just because, as I said, in the usual traditional way of doing things, that requires many advanced concepts to get here. Whereas, what I'll try to show you is that when you look at small devices, that lower one is the one that comes easily. I mean, that's what I'll do in the next half an hour, actually. So it takes about half an hour, really, at best, to get there. Okay? When you look at small devices. It's just that when you look at big devices, you need to get to chapter 13 before you get there. Okay. And one of the things you'll see, the value of this way of looking at it rather than that one, is if you look at this topic of like conductivity of graphene. As you know, that's a very quote-unquote hot topic. Everyone's interested in understanding that. And what makes it kind of unusual compared to everything else is with most other materials, we think of energy-momentum relations, these EK relations that people write. It looks something like this. And so it's parabolic, E goes as K squared, and that's this M, that's what you call the effective mass. So when you use a formula like this, this M that appears here is not the mass of a free electron, not the usual mass, it's this effective mass. It's different for every solid. Where does it come from? Well, you have to know the band structure, to know this EK relationship to get there. Okay. Now graphene, though, has a linear EK relation. That looks something like this. And that immediately causes problems with what's its mass. Because, well, you know, if it looked like this, you can see the mass. If it looks like this, you don't see the mass right away. Now, what you learn in all these texts usually is that the way you can define mass for any EK relation is something like this. 1 over M is proportional to d2e dk2. I think there's a h bar squared there, but apart from that. So that's what you usually learn for your qualifying exams and things like that. And if you use that here, of course, with a linear relationship, you can see d2e dk2 is zero. So that tells you the mass is infinite. And in the literature, usually though, there's a little more confusion even because usually people talk of massless Dirac particles when they talk of graphene. So depending on how you argue, you could say M is zero or infinite, one of those. But the thing is, doesn't matter whether you use zero or infinite, you're in trouble if you're trying to use this formula. You can put zero or infinity, it's not getting you very far. Okay. On the other hand, if you're using this one, then there's actually no real problem at all. Density of states, sure. Given any EK relationship, you can figure out the density of states. There's a standard way of doing it. There's no particular problems there. And diffusion coefficient, well, this diffusion coefficient is like V squared tau. It's like that. Typical velocity of electrons squared times the mean free time averaged, the average value over many electrons. That's what diffusion coefficient. There's really no particular problem. So this is just one example I was trying to give you that while for standard conductors, those two things are the same and you can show that one would lead you to the other, there are many cases where this will work but that won't. And this is really the more general one. And the only reason you don't know too much about it is that normally it takes you lots of advanced theory to get here. You see? So, what I'll be trying to do then in the next 20 to 30 minutes, or 22, yeah, is about this one. Trying to explain this and how it follows when you take this bottom-up view of things. Okay? Which means start with small conductors. Now, when you look at one of these conductors, and if you ask the question that how do we, you know, why do electrons flow from one side to the other? For small conductors, and actually for big conductors too, I'd say, the way to think about it is something like this. That you have this conductor here, you can find, in fact, there's something you can experimentally measure, the density of available states. So this is the energy axis. What I'm plotting on this side is the density of states. What that tells you is, within a given range of energies, how many states do you have? So the dimensions would be like per electron volt, how many states do you have? That's the density of states. And any material that you're interested in, graphene, silicon, whatever it is, would have a corresponding density of states that you can measure through independent experiments, experimentally. So you could do photo emission measurements, hit it with light, see how they come out, that will tell you about the density of states. Okay. Now, these are contacts, which are big things with lots of states, more or less uniform, no particular structure. And those are all occupied up to some point, which you call the chemical potential, mu one. Similarly, on this side, they would be occupied up to some point, which is called the chemical potential. And so at equilibrium, you'd have the same chemical potential everywhere. When you apply a voltage, they are separated by the applied voltage. So basically, you'd have mu1 minus mu2 is equal to qv, where V is the applied voltage. So this side is negative, so it raises all the energy levels on this side. Negative makes it, all these are electron energies, get higher, mu1 is higher, mu2 is lower, that's it. Okay. Now, why does current flow? The argument's simple, goes something like this, that if you look at these states here, what happens is this contact would like to keep them filled because the basic idea is every contact wants to keep everything filled up to the electrochemical potential. Electrochemical potential is a line that kind of divides the filled from the empty. So this is, it's all filled up to here. It would like to bring this into equilibrium with itself, so it would like to fill these up. On the other hand, this contact would like to empty it because this is lower. So what happens is, this contact keeps filling it up, that contact keeps emptying it. And this just goes on forever. And that's why current flows, essentially. Electrons keep coming out here, and once they're out here, of course, they get sucked out into the battery, and a new one comes in from there, and current keeps flowing. That's about it. So when you think from this point of view, you see, that's what really drives the current. And here again, I'd say, what you read in freshman physics texts usually is, why does current flow? Well, it's because of the electric field. And that, of course, immediately causes some confusion because, firstly, of course, even before you apply put on a battery, any material has lots of electric fields in it because of all the atoms and the nucleus and everything. So what's different between those electric fields and the one you put in anyway? That's number one. Number two, though, that's the more important one, and that is that if it's due to electric fields, then there is really no good reason why we are only talking of these electrons and not about all the other electrons in here. If it's due to electric fields, everything should be moving, you see? And that's where, of course, usually what you say is, well, you know, there is this mysterious quantum mechanical thing that stops filled bands from moving. So you only look at the empty bands, etc. Or the half-filled bands. Never look at the... So already you say you're bringing in a mysterious force to explain something that's really very simple. Namely that these states, they conduct because this contact wants to fill it up, that contact wants to empty it, and that's why current flows. Why don't these states conduct? Very simple. Well, this contact wants to fill them up, that contact wants to fill them up, it just stays filled. Nothing much happens thereafter. That's it. So there's really no mysterious force. It's just the difference between two Fermi functions, this F1 and F2. That's what determines what current flows. And the reason current flows only in this window is because that's where there's a difference. It doesn't flow here because there's no difference here. It doesn't flow up here because there's no difference there either. That's the thing. Okay. Now, we could make this into a quantitative expression for current if we assume what you call an elastic resistor. And this is the concept that, as I said, some 20, 30 years ago would have been almost considered absurd. So what I mean by that is, you see, this elastic resistor means, the picture we have in mind is, electrons come in from here, they go through your device and then get out there, and inside the device, they do not exchange energy with anything. So if they came in with a particular energy, they have exactly the same energy coming out. They could get scattered around, they could turn around and all that, but the point is energy is the same. So you could be moving forwards with some energy, then you might turn around a little bit with some other energy, that's fine, but the energy is the same. Now the reason that would be considered almost absurd is that, after all, if you have a resistor, there's heating, I squared R. And heating means electrons give up energy to the surroundings. That's what resistance is about, the way people normally think. But what is now fairly clear is that in really small devices, electrons actually don't lose much of their energy inside the conductor. All the heating actually takes place around here and around here. So the idea is that once an electron goes through there, it's got excess energy compared to this, and so inside that contact, they quickly lose energy and go down. And here, of course, an empty spot was left behind, which gets filled up. And so all the heating really, in small devices, takes place at the ends. And this is now fairly well experimentally established, I'd say, because the amount of current you run through, like some of these carbon nanotubes, some of these small things, if all the heating were actually in the conductor, it would have burnt up. And the understanding is the reason it doesn't burn up is because the heating's in the contacts, and the contacts are big things, and they can dissipate all that heat without burning up. See? So, now, so this is what I'd call an elastic resistor. And as I said, this kind of sounds a little wrong almost because, after all, elastic means you can't get rid of the heat. And the point is that the heat is being dissipated in the contacts. In small devices, that's the way, it's very close to what really happens there. And the point I want to make, and I'll come back to it, is that it also actually gives you a lot of insight into how big devices work. Because in big devices, of course, a lot of the heating is in between. But you could think of big devices as lots of these little things in series, one after the other. So if you understood one of those simple, small things, you could find out the resistance of that, and then think of the big thing as a lot of them in series, really. So you can understand big things with small, once you understand this one. Now the nice thing about this one is that electrons with every energy stick to whichever energy they are moving in, and so you can almost calculate the current one energy channel at a time. So you say, okay, at this energy, what do we have? At this energy, what do we have? And then just add it up. At the end of the day, you just add them all up. This is what you can do in a big device. You see, in a big device, someone comes in here, halfway through it, somewhere down here, then it's up there, and then it's up there, and then you can't quite tell the current is at which energy. You can't quite divide that up. You see, but once you have this elastic resistor, where electrons stick to their energy channel, then you see conceptually every channel is independent. We could do it one at a time. So how do you write down the current at a particular energy? Well, we could say something like this. So supposing, to start with, we think of just one level there. Just one level that you're talking about. Then you could say, well, the current is charge on an electron divided by the time it takes for an electron to get from here to there. So it's almost like you have this little one level that the electron has to squeeze through. And every picosecond or every nanosecond, there'd be one that would be able to get through from one to the other, one side to the other. And that's what I'm calling the time. So you could say, if you had just one level, that's what it would be. Time that an electron takes to get from one side to the other. Now, when you have a lot of states there, then you could say, well, let's look at a range of energies dE, and the number of states is density of states times dE. So this is the range of energies. This is the density of states per unit energy. So in that range, the number of states is this. If you had only one state, that's what you'd have got. Since you have a few states, we have this. And usually to get it right, you need to divide by two. And divide by two because the argument usually goes that, well, of these states, usually half are kind of helping you get from left to right. The other half are kind of going the other direction. So the way I often think of it is it's like on a highway, you got four lanes going this way, four lanes going that way. DE, the density of states, tells you a total thing, eight lanes, but then only half are for going north, the other are for going south. So that's the two. Now, okay, maybe I'll write this up here so we don't lose it. So that would be the current if we only had electrons going from left to right. But in general, what would happen is there's some coming in from here trying to get that way, some coming in from that side going the other way, and the difference is what will determine the net current. And so you have this F1 minus F2. And these are these Fermi functions. So the Fermi function, that basically tells you how these states are occupied inside the contact. And typically it would look something like this. So if this axis is energy, the Fermi function. So if I were to draw the Fermi function, it's like, roughly speaking, as I said, everything up to the chemical potential is filled, this electrochemical potential. What that means, roughly speaking, F is 1 below it, and it is 0 above it. And it goes from 1 to 0 over an energy range of the order of kT, a few kT. There's this formal function that I could write down, this Fermi function, but I think that's not needed. It's just the picture that's important here. That it's 0 up here, and then goes to 1. And I'm sure you have seen this function before. Only thing that might need a little reorienting is I've drawn it the wrong way. What I mean by that is, usually when you draw a function, you like to have the independent variable along the x-axis. So here the independent variable is energy. So that's what you'd like to draw along the x-axis. Except that because all these density of states and everything I've drawn this way, I've got the energy axis this way. So I've kind of turned it around from the way you'd normally draw it. That's about it. Much. Okay. Similarly, if you wanted to draw F2, the Fermi function for the other contact, it would have looked something like this. So it will be 1 below mu 2, 0 above mu 2. Okay. And the point is that the current depends on the difference between the two. That's this physical point I'd made starting out. That the reason you have a current is simply because one contact is trying to keep this occupied according to F1, and that one's trying to keep it occupied according to F2. That's this difference that we're talking about. So that's this. Okay. And if you want to take into account the fact that you have many energy channels, then all you have to do is put an integral sign here. You integrate it over all energies. But given any range of energies, this is the current. That's it. And that's the beauty of this elastic resistor. You can do it one energy at a time, just add it all up. Okay? Now, in order to get a conductance out of this, the way we do it is something like this. That if you look at F1 minus F2, so what you're talking about is the difference between that Fermi function and that Fermi function. You see, in fact, let me draw them all on the same one so you kind of see it. So one F1 is that, and the other F2 is this. So one of them is a little lower than the other. And if we are talking about small voltages, small compared to KT in this context, then what you can show is that that difference will look something like this. So this function here, that's this derivative of the Fermi function, basically, in a way. So the difference between the two is like this derivative of the Fermi function times the difference between the two chemical potentials. So you could write this quantity as minus del F del E at equal, I might say, well, do I use F1 or F2? Well, we are talking of small potential so that it's almost the same. So the derivative of the equilibrium thing, whatever you had, the equal thing that you had on both sides, that's del F del E. I'll put a del F 0 to remind us of that, times mu 1 minus mu 2. That's it. And mu 1 minus mu 2, that is, of course, this applied voltage QV. So this we could write as QV. So overall then, what we get is something like this. Think I got everything in there. And so if you want conductance, remember I was trying to write current. So current proportional to voltage. So I'd write the I over V. I could write like this is equal to this. That's it. Now, if you want to bring in this integral, you could do that now. You know, that's also here, of course. It's basically a sum over all these energy channels. Now, this integral you can interpret in an interesting way, and that is this, that this derivative that I've written here, integral over this thing, that's essentially like taking the average value of this quantity. So what I mean by that is something like this. Supposing temperature was very low. In that case, this thing that I've drawn here would have been extremely sharp. On the other hand, as you raise the temperature, it gets broader. But what you can show is that the area under this thing stays the same. As you raise the temperature, it'll get broader, but the area is the same. It's one under that thing. And so at low temperatures, this is like what you might call a delta function. And in that case, this conductance would simply be whatever this happens to be right at the chemical potential. On the other hand, as you raise the temperature, it will be a kind of average of this quantity over a range of energies given here. So at zero temperatures, it's exactly what it is at that energy. Whatever density of d over 2t happens to be right there. On the other hand, you raise the temperature, you have to take its average. So you could view it as if, you see, write this here. You think of a conductance as a function of energy. What that means is, if your chemical potential were exactly at that energy and temperature was zero, then the conductance you'd get would be Q square D over 2T. So, and D being this density of states that we talked about. And the understanding is that, well, if you're not at zero temperature, then what you have to do is
take that and average it. So in general, if you want the conductance, you would have to do something like this. So conductance at low temperatures, if your Fermi energy is there, it's that. In general, you have to average it. Okay. And actually, this expression I had written down earlier, saying that conductivity depends on density of states and diffusivity, that also actually the full form, which I kind of didn't bring in earlier, is really more like this. This is sigma of E. This is the conductivity if your chemical potential is at a given energy, and then you should use the density of states at that energy, of course, wherever the chemical potential happens to be. On the other hand, if you actually want the conductivity, then you'd have to do integral dE minus del F0 del E sigma of E. So that's how this one is supposed to work. Okay? Now, what I want to spend the next few minutes is showing you how this expression would lead to that expression for conductivity. That's basically what I'm trying to get at. Okay. Now, what you have here is this density of states. So you see, you're kind of there. That's the density of states that I mentioned. But then I have this T, which is the time it takes for an electron to get from left to right. You see? Okay. Now, if this is a ballistic conductor, it means where electrons just have a certain velocity, go straight through. As I said, we have assumed electrons are elastic in the sense they don't change energy, but what they could do is they could be going this way at some speed and then turn around and go in some other direction with some speed, then turn around a little bit and then come back down, etc. That would be a diffusive conductor where you're changing the direction all the time, but still the same energy. On the other hand, ballistic means like a bullet. You go straight. No turning around. Go straight where you're going. That's it. Okay? Now, if it's ballistic, then you see it's very easy to write down the T. Then T is length divided by velocity in the Z direction. So, of course, you might have electrons which some were going straight, some were going at some other angle. It's ballistic means they keep doing whatever they were doing when they got in. But then it could be different angles, so you'd have to take the average value. But that gives you a certain numerical factor. But other than that, this is it. So you could write conductance then as Q square times D over 2L. And I'm writing here U for the average value of Vz, whatever that is. I mean, I could have just written Vz for this purpose. But the point is, this then would be the conductance of a ballistic conductor. Q square, density of states, average velocity, 2L. That's it. Now, of course, the expression I'm trying to get is this one, which applies to diffusive conductors. So let me talk about that and then I'll come back to this again. Take this out from here. The idea is that, you see, for ballistic conductors, it's relatively easy to write down this time. Okay, got certain length divided by velocity. But what if you have electrons which just don't go straight, but go, you know, like a drunken person, you know, it's like going around like this. Question is, how long does that take to get through a certain length? And this is where, in this theory of random walks, you see, there is a standard result that you may have seen. If not, it's a standard thing you can look up, is that the time it takes is not proportional to the length, but proportional to L squared. And usually this
time, instead of what I've written here, you'd see T is equal to L squared divided by 2 times the diffusion coefficient. And this diffusion coefficient is this average value of Vz squared tau. So this is this velocity that it goes in any particular direction, and the average squared value of that, that's what determines this diffusion coefficient. This is the time. And if you insert that in here, you'd get q squared d over L square d bar. I think I got that. Yeah, that's it. Now, I think we're almost there. You'll see the q squared d bar meaning the diffusion coefficient and the density of states. But the thing is, I write this in a slightly different form, because one thing you know is that for big conductors, the conductance should be conductivity times cross-sectional area divided by length. Now, the thing is that as you go to big conductors, the density of states usually scales up with volume, which is why when you talk of big conductors, you talk of the density of states per unit volume. Whereas I used density of states as like the total density of states. Okay? So what I'll do is I'll put an A here and put an A up there. And I'll take one of these L's from here and keep it here. That way, whatever is here, I could call conductivity. So you say, okay, conductance is conductivity times A over L. That's it. And that's this expression that I'd written down before. You see? Which is, as I said, not a new expression at all. It appears in all standard solid-state texts. It's just that usually it's in chapter 13. Because you have to use advanced formalisms like Boltzmann formalism or Kubo formalism to get there. And which is why it's not as widely known as the other one, which is everywhere. Okay. Now, and what allowed us to get to this rather fast is because, again, we just talked about this elastic resistor. Because we had this simple way of saying that, hey, we'll look at how electrons go through at one energy and add them all up. Something that only works for small things. Big things, it's not like that. And so you might say, well, but that formula is supposed to apply to big conductors. Why is that this looks like that? And there I'd say the justification, which I won't go into, is that if you really had a big conductor, you could view it as lots of these little ones in series. So if you take one of those little ones and figure out its resistance, then if you had two of them, well, it would just be twice as much, thrice as much, etc. That's it. So that's why the answer you get from the small thing also applies to the big thing. It's just that it helps you, it allows you to get there very fast. See, that's the thing. The other nice thing about this way of doing it is it also shows you the connection to the ballistic thing. Because usually, as I said, diffusive conduction, you know, there are two different fields almost in people's minds. There is the normal devices and then there are the small devices. There's the ballistic one, which is a whole different field altogether. But lots of devices today are kind of in the gray area. And it would be good to be able to think of all that in the same vein. And the point I'm trying to make is, well, this applies to everything. It's just that if the time is if you determine it from diffusive conduction, you'll get the standard thing. If you get the time from ballistic conduction, you'll get the results for ballistic transport. In fact, one of the interesting things you see right away is that for ballistic transport, you see, as I had mentioned earlier, the density of states is proportional to area, the volume. So you could write this as q square d over al u. And then there would be an area. I guess there's a 2 here, I'll write that. So the important thing you notice is that for Ohm's law, for diffusive conductors, conductance is proportional to area over length, as you learn in freshman physics. But for ballistic conductors, the conductance is only proportional to area. Doesn't depend on length.
which is exactly what is seen experimentally. When you have a carbon nanotube in the ballistic limit, you could make it twice as long, it's still the same conductance. Resistance doesn't change because believed it's all due to the interfaces. It really doesn't matter how long the middle thing is. And that's a result that just comes out automatically from here. You can see that it's not divided by length anymore. Because, of course, density of states is proportional to the volume. So this number is independent of dimensions. So that's how it goes. Okay. But the other point that this whole viewpoint helps emphasize is that, again, current flow is because of this difference between Fermi functions, which is why it is limited to this range of energies. Because one of the most confusing things I've seen in this discussion of transport is this thing about why, if electrons are driven by electric fields, why isn't it that all the energy levels don't contribute to it? And that's where you have to invoke a mysterious quantum mechanical force that stops everyone else from moving. And then when you get to small things, you have to worry about which ones are stopped and which ones are not. But the point is that entire mysterious quantum mechanical thing is really about F1 minus F2. It's really just this. See? Okay. Now, what I'd like to talk about for the next 20 minutes or so, is this other thing that many of you have expressed interest in, that's the NEGF and the quantum transport, which a lot of you have interest in. It's because whatever I've discussed here so far, you'd say is what you might call semi-classical view. That is, you're thinking of electrons as particles. And the question you could say is, well, if I want to do a quantum description, as many devices which involve tunneling and other things would require, how would one go about it? And that is where there is a very well-defined method of doing it, formalism, this NEGF formalism. In this summer school, I believe, there is only one session where you'll see some of that, and that's the one run by Professor Klimek, where he'll be talking to you about some of the simulation tools he has based on NEGF for doing real devices. But what I want to say is a few words about the basic philosophy behind it and what's involved. Okay? That's what I'll be doing in the next 15 minutes or so. Now, if you were to describe quantum transport, of course, the starting point, as you might expect, should be like the Schrodinger equation. That's what describes the quantum mechanics of electrons. And the usual Schrodinger equation would look something like this. This is the general time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And there is this time-independent Schrodinger equation, which is E psi equals H psi. And I've kind of put a tilde on top to denote this is the time-dependent one. And usually if you assume that the psi has the form of e to the power minus I e t over H bar, if you assume that it has the it varies in time in this form, then this will get you here. And this H is usually this differential operator. I mean, that's the thing you'll see in most textbooks. That's what you'll see printed on T-shirts. That's a differential operator usually. Now, the thing is that in terms of doing actual calculations, what people usually do is turn that differential operator into a matrix. That's the version you often don't see much. And the idea is that you can represent any device using a set of basis functions or grid points. And if you have, say, 100 grid points or basis functions, then that differential operator becomes a 100 by 100 matrix. See?
And that form is the one that's most convenient in terms of discussing real problems here. So the way I'll think about this is, let's say this is a 100 by 100 matrix, for example. Okay. Now, for this discussion, to start with, let's think of the simplest device where it's really just one level, which means just a 1 by 1 matrix. What that means is it's just a number. That's the simplest thing you can think of. In general, as I said, this H would be a matrix, n by n, 100 by 100, whatever it is. And I guess you'll hear about, you know, million atom simulations. I mean, where this H is like a million by million, big matrices. Okay. So, but for this discussion, let's just start with, say, something that's like 1 by 1. So what that means is this is, say, just one number, epsilon. Whatever that is. And that would correspond to having a device which is just one level. Okay? Because that illustrates the essential point, and we'll go on from there. But now, here then, the corresponding thing is this E psi is equal to epsilon psi. Now the point is, how would we describe the current flow? Now, this Schrodinger equation as it stands is not good enough, as it stands, because it only describes this isolated system. It doesn't tell you about the contacts. You have connected it to two contacts. As I said, the essence of current flow is these two contacts. Why does current flow? Well, because this one keeps putting an electron in, that one keeps pulling it out. And if you just write this, then your equations don't know about all these things that's in your head, that about how an electron came in, etc. That needs to get into the math. Okay? Now, so the way you do this is two things. One is, you see, this one, I could write it as E minus epsilon times psi. So ordinarily, I would have written it this way. And in the presence of contact, what you need to do is add an imaginary number like this. So there's some imaginary quantity. And what I claim is, effectively that describes the contacts. Why is that? Well, to see this, you kind of need to look at the time-dependent version here. So if you look at here, it would look something like this. So look at the time-dependent version. As I had mentioned earlier, if you didn't have this, the solution would have looked something like this. That's what it would have looked like if this extra term were not there. Now, if you include this, then the corresponding solution looks like so by adding this little thing here, this imaginary part, the solution now has a decaying exponent to it. Now what that means is, if I look at the probability that the electron is in that level, that's like psi star psi. If I look at the psi star psi, at t, you see, if I didn't have this, then when I take the psi star psi, this being a purely this phase factor here, when you multiply it by its complex conjugate, it just drops out. So the probability stays the same. So you'd have at zero, wouldn't change at all. But now that I have this part, of course, it will change with time. It will look like so by adding this extra thing here, what it means is when I actually try to solve this equation and get the physics out of it, I'll find that the probability will be decaying with time. And physically I'd say, okay, that makes sense because I've connected this thing to contacts, So if I put an electron there, it won't stay there forever. Sooner or later, it'll just escape out into the contacts.
And how fast it escapes, that's what this is. So roughly speaking, what's this gamma that I put in there? Well, this gamma over h bar, h bar over gamma has the dimensions of time. And it sort of tells you how easily an electron escapes from that level into the contacts. So if you have good contacts, electrons escape, say, in a picosecond. Okay, in that case, choose your gamma such that h bar over gamma is a picosecond. And you'll find that a picosecond will give you about a millivolt, roughly speaking, millielectron volt. And if it's a nanosecond, well, this will then be much smaller, etc. So, to include this effect of contacts, you'd need something like this. So that's this part. Now, of course, if we just do this, it still doesn't have the full physics, because all it tells you is that if an electron I put inside, it will go out. But, of course, electrons are continually coming in from the contacts. You see, if I just were to solve this equation, the answer is simple. It's psi equals zero for this one. That means there's no electrons in the long run. And that's true, of course. If you just put an electron inside and the contacts were all empty, nothing ever came in from the contacts, in the long run, there won't be any around. It'll just all go out. Sure. But what we want to include is the fact that you've got electrons that are coming in, represented by those Fermi functions and so on. And so you need something like a source term here. And that source depends on this Fermi function. So you've got these two contacts. There'll be stuff coming in from one that will be proportional to the Fermi function in that contact. There'll be stuff coming in from the other that is the Fermi function of that contact. That physics has to go into this S. So here I was just trying to explain this with a one by one. If I was going to do this more generally, you know, when I actually have a full matrix, it would look something like this. You see, the standard Schrodinger equation would have looked like this. As I said, E psi equals H psi. Actually, to be consistent, I should put the identity matrix here. This is a number. That's the identity matrix of the same size as H. And in general, the H is a matrix. So E psi equals H psi could be written this way. That would be the standard Schrodinger equation. The modified Schrodinger equation, the one that takes into account the contacts, would look something like this. You'd have to add some quantity here, which is usually called this self-energy, sigma, which is, you'll note, not real. In general, it would kind of have an imaginary part, or actually, in more technical terms, an anti-Hermitian part. This is Hermitian, that is non-Hermitian. And in general, it could also have a real part that goes with it. But the point is, this is what it would generally look like, and this is due to the contacts. And then, we need a source term on this side, S. So this is kind of, if you are trying to do this from Schrodinger equation, this is what it would sort of look like. Okay. Now, why is it that you use this something else, this NEGF equations, which do not quite look like the Schrodinger equation? If you looked at that, you wouldn't recognize it here. So why do you need something else? Well, the thing is that if you just use this, you'll get all kinds of unphysical results. In the sense that, well, for the source term, we'd say, okay, I've got something coming in from the source and something coming in from the drain. So you say, okay, I've got a S1 that comes from, say, the source side, and then there's an S2 that comes from the drain side. This is proportional to the Fermi function in the F1. This is Fermi function in drain 2. Okay, so you calculate the psi, and then you say, well, now I want electron density, so I'll find, say, psi psi star. In matrix terms, it would be psi psi dagger, let's say. Well, the point is, when you try to do that, you'll get things that will look like this, things that will look like this, and you will also get things that will have cross products. Because when I take something like this and multiply it by its complex conjugate or conjugate transpose, you end up with four types of things, And in the real world, when people do experiments, no one ever sees these interference terms. Because what comes in from the two contacts has no phase relationship between them. It varies randomly. Anything you measure averaged over time, you wouldn't see any evidence of any phase relationship between them, by and large. So this is never there. What is all there? So what that means is, if you want this, write down these equations that you can use for analyzing devices, it's hard to start from here and work. I mean, you can, but then you have to remember that you should, if you have multiple sources, you should find the electron density due to this and that separately, and then remember to add them up separately. If you calculated the wave function by adding it all up and then went to psi star, it would be all wrong. See? So what the NEGF equations do is, they give you an equation that's directly in terms of the quantities like this, instead of size. So it would work something like this. Let's say, you see, that's the Schrodinger equation. So what you could do is, from here I can write psi is equal to, from there I could write psi is equal to Gs, where this G is not conductance. It is, this was called the Green, this is a Green function. This, of this non-equilibrium Green function method, I guess, this is Green's function. Nothing to do with conductance, totally different entity. And this G is then defined as the inverse of that matrix. That's the G. And then what I need is something called psi dagger, which would be like G S S dagger. G dagger. And so this is the strength of the source term, which is called sigma n, let's say. And this is this electron density type of thing, Gn. So the final equation would be something like this. And this is the strength of the source term. It would have a part that depends on the Fermi function in contact one, part that depends on the Fermi function in contact two. So you'd have things that will be F1 times something plus something times F2, etc. And these are basically the NEGF equations. So these are the equations one actually tries to solve. And it's really coming out of Schrodinger equation in a way, but the point is when you're working here, you don't see the connection at all, overall. You see? That's the point. Now, just want to make 2 points, and I think I can wind up on this. Okay, first thing is about this H and the sigma. That is, usually when you read the literature, and in most courses and all, the emphasis is always on the H. And I often run into people who say something like this, that, well, you know, your sigma is kind of an approximation after all. It's approximation for that contact. Right? You say that, well, you know, because I could write an H for everything. And, you know, you are using this sigma as an approximation so you can get by with a smaller matrix. See, and we don't like making approximations. See, we have a big computer, so we don't really care. We'll just use a big H. And the point is there's something not quite right about that. Because if you use a big H, your computer won't know that there is a battery which keeps putting in electrons and taking them out. Because remember, at the end of the day, current flows because there's this thing coming in and there's this thing going out. And there's something outside that maintains this contact at equilibrium with some electrochemical potential. And something else that maintains this at equilibrium with some other electrochemical potential. Now, when you do it this way, of course, the computer knows about it. There's the F1 and the F2. The Fermi functions are going in there. But it doesn't matter how big the computer is. If you're just working with a Hamiltonian, H, then you see the computer doesn't know about the Fermi functions. Now, often what happens is you kind of know the answers and you conclude it various ways. But the thing is, if you want to do it right, Fermi functions need to be somewhere in there. Really. And the NEGF method, of course, lets you puts that in a natural way. So that's one point. And the other point I wanted to make is that, you see, the sigma I wrote down as the thing that describes the connection to these two contacts. Now, in general, though, of course, you see, throughout this lecture so far, I've focused on this elastic resistor because that helps clarify the concepts and so on. But in general, of course, you are dealing with inelastic resistors where electrons, as it goes through, exchanges energies with the energy with the surroundings. And even if it didn't exchange energy, it could be exchanging momentum with the surroundings and other thing. And you would need another sigma that tells you the connection with the surroundings.
Sigma.
So you have a sigma 1 that tells you the connection with this contact, a sigma 2 that tells you the connection with that contact, a Hamiltonian that tells you what's in here, and then there is the interaction with the surroundings, the sigma 0. Now, the equations I have written here, that still holds, where what I wrote as sigma is the sum of all those. It's sigma 1 plus sigma 2 plus sigma 0, everything together. And what I wrote here as sigma n, it's got all of them. You know, I told you there would be a part that's due to 1, there would be a part that's due to 2, there could be a part that's due to the interaction with the surroundings. All of that is part of here, you see. So it's the same equation though, but in general you would have this. And historically this is kind of important because, as I mentioned, before the rise of mesoscopic physics and nanoelectronics and all this, which is like about 20 years old now. Before that, whenever people talked about transport, whenever people talked about resistance, all the physics was really in the sigma zero. Resistance, if you were doing a theory of resistance, it was understood that you were doing a theory of the sigma zero, not the sigma one or the sigma two. Because, as I said, before 1990, theorists, when they were writing papers, they would never even draw the contacts. Contacts were just a minor detail in the whole thing. No one worried about that. Real physics was all in the middle, the sigma zero. And by contrast, of course, right now what we are doing is we said, let's talk about the elastic resistor, where the sigma zero is negligible. All the physics is in the sigma one and the sigma two. That's what we talked about for the last hour, really. It is all about the sigma one and the sigma two. And that's what makes it, I'd say, in a way, simple. Because the theory of this sigma zero is a whole lot harder than the theory of sigma one and sigma two. And a lot of these simulation tools even today, I say, that you'll hear about that, you say, often neglect the sigma zero. Because including the sigma zero is not only harder conceptually, but also numerically to implement and make it all work. It's actually much harder. Okay. But that also, I want to just make a comment about the general literature that often people ask me that, well, you know, when I read the literature, this NEGF literature, it doesn't look anything like what you're saying. It looks a lot more complicated. And the reason is something like this. Of course, again, the basic equations that I wrote down here, those were derived, I'd say, back in the 60s. You know, this is the work that started with Schwinger and then Keldysh, Karanoff and Baim. There's a paper by Keldysh in 1965 in JETP, the Soviet literature, which basically has these equations. These are the two basic equations of NEGF. Non-equilibrium Green function. And to complete it, I'd need to give you an equation to calculate the current. But other than that, this is it. So this is what you'd see, as I said, if you looked at Keldysh's 1965 paper on NEGF. That's the equations you'll see. But the focus, how were those equations derived? Well, it was derived using what's called many-body perturbation theory, which, for those of you who haven't seen it, and I assume many of you haven't seen it before, it takes many semesters to really master. This is this many-body theory, the many-body perturbation theory that takes you here. But the way I see it is that many-body perturbation theory, I mean, looking back today, it would be like, that's about the theory of how you find the sigma and the sigma n, especially this part, the sigma zero part, that interaction part. And that, as we go along, we may find other ways of finding it. I mean, lots of times what people use today are not exactly what you'd have got out of many-body perturbation theory, but some approximate version that seems to capture the physics fairly well. That's what people use, and as we'll go along, we'll see what happens. You know, people will be using other things. So, what I believe is there's no reason to kind of mix up these equations and the derivation of these with the many-body perturbation theory that you need or may need to calculate the sigma zero. Especially since, as I said, a lot of the applications, you may not even need that part, the sigma zero, sigma n part. And these equations themselves, as I tried to show you, you could get it straight from the one electron Schrodinger equation, you know, without any sophisticated formalism, really. It comes from here fairly straightforwardly. And you can write down the sigma 1 and the sigma 2 again using fairly straightforward quantum mechanics, really, without getting into all of that. But a lot of the literature, again, because of the history, tends to mix up those two things. And that's not the case with the Boltzmann equation, for example. You know, the Boltzmann equation looks something like this. There is this distribution function that obeys an equation like this. What is on the left-hand side comes from Newton's law. What is on the right-hand side is about all the scattering processes. That's what makes it irreversible. That's what makes it a transport theory. How do you calculate the scattering operator and all that? Well, you use Fermi's golden rule often these days. Did Boltzmann know about Fermi's golden rule? Not really. He died in 1906, about 20 years before Schrodinger wrote down his equation. So over the years, how you calculate this has evolved. Today's devices, they use something. Okay? And there is no reason to mix up that with basically Boltzmann equation. So to me, the NEGF equations are kind of the quantum version of Boltzmann. What Boltzmann did was he took Newton's dynamics, showed how to add scattering to it. What the NEGF equations tell you is, start from Schrodinger dynamics and show how to add all these other scattering things and contacts into it. And how you find the sigma and the sigma n, that's like the equivalent of the scattering part of that story. That will evolve with time. As you'll see different devices, you'll find different approximations that will work better, etc. But to me, the basic NEGF equations are these. And this is again another example where I say it's like this lessons from nanoelectronics, that by looking at small devices, you get a whole different view or perspective about big devices. Thank you.